Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, you know, I would guess that basically all of our listeners know who John Steinbeck was, author of The Grapes of Wrath, Of Mice and Men, and other great novels that we read in high school and college, including Cannery Row. Our show today centers around the main character of Cannery Row called Doc, who was an actual person, a longtime friend of Steinbeck's, a marine biologist named Ed Ricketts. He ran a business called the Pacific Biological Laboratory in Monterey, California, right in the middle of the sardine canning factories from which Cannery Row got its name. And in 1940, Ricketts and Steinbeck went on a great adventure together, a biological collecting expedition to the Gulf of California, also called the Sea of Cortez, between the Baja California Peninsula down there and mainland Mexico. So to do it, they chartered a big sardine fishing boat named the Western Flyer. So now we come to the real heart of today's show. If you've been listening to American Variety for very long, you know that we have a soft spot here for people who chase an unlikely dream, a long-shot goal or ambition that other people think is crazy or that they have no chance of succeeding at, but they do it and succeed. My guest today is one such person. His name is John Gregg. He's a geologist who owns a California-based geotechnical engineering and drilling company. He's in his 50s now, but when he was a young kid, he read the book that Steinbeck and Ricketts wrote about their expedition called The Log from the Sea of Cortez. And so John became fascinated with the story, with Steinbeck and Ricketts, and eventually with the whereabouts of their boat, the Western Flyer. And no one knew what had become of it. So John made it his mission to find out, and I'll let him take it from there. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Gordon. Yeah, I'm glad you saddled me with succeeding already. I thought the question was in doubt a little bit still, so I'm glad I got a voice of support there. That's great.
Well, you succeeded in finding it, and we'll talk about what you're doing with it from there. And from my perspective, it looks like you're well on the way. But we've talked about the Western Flyer. Just tell us about the boat and your search for it.
Yeah, the boat is a 77-foot sardine boat built in Tacoma in 1937, and it was built in just a couple of months. They put them together, usually three or four of them at a time, and they were basically the pickup trucks of their day for fishing. This one went down to Monterey to participate in the sardine harvest that was going on down there, and it stayed there for a few years, and it's where Steinbeck chartered it.
So what about your search for it? I mentioned that, you know, it was kind of unknown what had happened to the Western Flyer, but you made it your mission to track it down, and you did find it. So how did you go about that, and, you know, just kind of give us the story a little bit.
Yeah, I sort of Forrest Gumped my way along with it. I was curious about what had happened to it. I work with my business occasionally in the Pacific Northwest, and I would hear whispers of it. It would be alternately, oh, no, it was the Western Flyer was crushed up years ago, or, oh, no, it changed its name and it was up in Homer, Alaska. And I would just hear little tales of it. I never really tracked it down, but I would get enough encouragement to think that it might still exist. So the search itself that I took was probably over a period of 15 years, actually.
Wow.
Until I finally located it. I didn't actually locate it. A guy in Monterey did, a descendant of the original captain. Named Tony Berry was the captain, and Bob Ania was related to not only the captain, but also one of the deckhands on the boat, Sparky Ania. And he had spent years also looking for the boat. It was actually the captain on the voyage that Steinbeck went on, Tony Berry, that in his great old age actually is responsible for finding the boat. He remembered Bob Ania, his nephew, said, I can't find the boat. And Tony said, you know, boat never changes its call letters from its radio signal. So if you check with the Coast Guard, they'll probably have a record of it. And Bob Ania did. He had to check in Washington, D.C., and there was a record of the boat changing its name to the Gemini back in the early 60s when the Gemini space program was going on, and the owner of it then liked that program and so renamed the Western Flyer the Gemini, and then Bob was able to find it, and then I was able to find it from Bob's search.
Well, 15 years. There must have been times when you felt like you were looking for Bigfoot, right? am I really chasing a wild goose here?
Yeah, people would say, oh, you can go see the wheel. They took it off, and, you know, they were all basically just ephemeral sightings of it. So it was enough to keep me interested, but I didn't get very close to it, actually.
Yeah, but you did have two solid people helping you find it, which was good. So when you did find it, what was the condition of the boat, and where was it when you found it? I mean, what had been its most recent history? I'm asking that question because I know the answer. Anyway, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, So when Bob found it, he went back to Monterey and he tried to organize some public support on getting the boat, you know, restored and back to Monterey. The boat was sitting, I think it was used as a actually a channel marker. So it was basically just anchored out in the water with lights on it, basically as a buoy. And so Bob contacted the owner, and the owner, I think, wanted $40,000 for it. So Bob went back to Monterey to try to raise the $40,000. And, you know, Monterey is a pretty affluent community, and he talked to some people there, and they had a little gala, and they had a fundraising thing, and they only raised $10,000. But it was enough newspaper coverage that a developer in Salinas, which is Steinbeck's hometown, saw it and pounced on it and bought the boat and was putting together a restaurant in Salinas near the Steinbeck Museum and wanted to cut the boat up into three pieces and put it, you know, the bow in his restaurant and the stern as a meeting center. And so he had some grand plans to dissect it, which horrified the people in Monterey. But that's how I found it. I finally started seeing it, you know, appear in the newspaper.
Yeah, so he had no interest in really refurbishing it in any real way. He was just kind of using it as a sort of a restaurant brand in a way, almost like something you'd see in Key West or whatever. So, yeah, but I had read that it was actually had been sunk like four times or something. It was half rotten. I mean, it wasn't in good shape. You know, we're not picturing a floating intact boat that's seaworthy, right?
No, it was a disaster. Basically, I started contacting the owner. His name was a guy named Jerry Kehoe, kind of a tough old Irish restaurant guy. And he wouldn't even take my call. So this went on for a couple of years. In that time, sitting at the dock up in Washington State, it sank at its dock a few times. A board let go, and they would raise it and, you know, patch it up and pump it out, and it sank again. This time it was down on the bottom for, I think, 3 months. So it filled with silt and barnacles and everything else. It was in pretty bad shape.
Can I ask you what you ended up, obviously you ended up buying it, so you must have had to twist the arm of the restaurant owner pretty hard from the sound of it. What did you end up paying for it?
Yeah, that was a silly negotiation. He finally took my call, and I didn't know this, but you know, he realized there was no way he could even transport the boat. It was it was in too fragile of a condition. So I was basically negotiating myself, and I wanted it too bad, and he knew it, and I knew it. So he it was a strange negotiation. His lawyer was there. We sat at his restaurant, and he would just stare at me, and he wouldn't say a word to me. This lawyer would do all the talking. He would say, "Mr. Kehoe thinks the boat's worth $1 million. And, you know, I knew what he paid for it. And so I was coming in with a lot lower numbers, obviously. And this meeting, it went to two or three meetings later. I finally brought my brother, who is an attorney as well, and so I could have some backup. And he basically was kicking me under the table when I agreed to pay $1 million for the boat, which clearly it's not worth. But that, he knew I wanted it, and I knew I wanted it. And we both knew who was going to win that negotiation. So.
So there is one owner, and there's a potential buyer pool of one. You're the only person in the world who would have paid anything substantial for this half-rotten boat. But he knew, I guess he kind of had you over a barrel in the sense that it sounds more like love than business, right? And so he knew you were in love, basically. So.
Yeah, it's some kind of strange emotion. To add insult to injury, when I went up to take possession of the boat at the port in Port Townsend, they had declared it an environmental hazard because it was leaking battery acid and fuel and things. So they made me put up a $20,000 bond so I wouldn't skip town and leave them with this. So it was worth actually less than zero. It was worth negative $20,000.
Oh, my gosh. Well, my guess is he had looked you up and figured out roughly what your net worth and ability to pay was, and he was going to – it was his one shot.
I don't know.
It was his one shot to – you know, restaurants always lose money, so it was his one shot to really make money. And so,
yeah, clearly I was outmatched in that negotiation.
Anyway, well, that's funny. So where is it now, and what's the kind of the process of refurbishment, or maybe I should more accurately call it resurrection? Like, where is it, and what's going on with it right now, John?
So right now it's in Port Townsend. I was going to move it back down to Monterey, where I have some people that know how to work on boats. But when I went up there and looked around, there was guys with, you know, planes and hand tools and chisels and they were a bunch of craftsmen up there that apparently there's a wood boat school in Port Townsend that they turn out, you know, really skilled craftsmen in this ancient art. You know, there's I guess one on the East Coast as well. The boat happened to land in probably the best place it could be to find people that knew how to fix those things still. So the boat's been up there, and basically, you know, the first couple of years was just planning the restoration, where we laser measured the boat and found out what kind of condition it was really in. And it, you know, it sagged a little bit on one side, and it was a, you know, an 80-year-old boat, kind of tired. So we didn't want to do anything we didn't have to do to the boat to maintain its sort of authenticity. But also, my plans for the boat are that it will go back to sea, so it's not a museum piece. So we had to make the boat safe.
Sure.
First and foremost, so it required a different restoration than if we were just trying to make a dusty old museum piece.
Well, some guardian angel of yours was looking out for you to kind of make up for the $1 million by landing it, as you say, in the one place probably on the West Coast where there were craftsmen with the right knowledge and tools to work on a boat like this and bring it back to life in the way that it deserved, right? Because it is a unique vessel, and even though at the time it was chartered by Steinbeck and Ricketts, it wasn't unique. It may be now, because it's been a long time. So how often do you visit, and are you drawn to go up there every chance you get kind of thing and watch this go on? Because it must be pretty interesting to watch these skilled artisans.
Yeah, it's really interesting, but I'm disruptive when I go up there, because I start, you know, waving my arms and spouting off things that I don't know anything about. But the boat does, you mentioned that, you know, it's guardian angel. The boat, it's, without getting too weird about it, it's got a palpable sense of self, and everybody that goes near it says that. And it also had this knack for survival. After it did its little six-week voyage with Steinbeck and Ricketts, it had this really interesting life where it would plunder the ocean, and then it would protect it. Like it would get hired by what now is the precursor of the fish and game to do, you know, fish studies, because people were starting to realize that they were depleting the oceans. And then it would, when the study was over and it would go off a charter, it would go out and catch all the fish that it studied. So it had a really interesting life. And in fact, there was this fish called an ocean perch, which is, it's not really a perch. It's like it's almost like a rockfish of some sort. It's an orange fish that lives, you know, in rocky little crevices. And they're really old fish. They don't get to breeding age till they're 30 or 40 years old. So the fisheries on the West Coast, probably everywhere, there's a pack mentality. When the sardines were depleted, all of the fishermen in Monterey and along California went up to Washington State and were fishing these ocean perch. And so were, you know, other countries. There were, you know, Portuguese and different, a bunch of Chinese fishermen and Filipino fishermen in there. And they were coming right up to the coast of Washington, and they were bottom dragging for these fish. When they would catch a rock or something in their net, they would bring it on deck, and then they didn't want to catch that rock again, so they would, you know, throw it overboard somewhere where they weren't fishing. So that not only were they, you know, catching all these ocean perch that were 50, 60, 70 years old, they were destroying their habitat. And so they were rapidly depleting this resource. So that the flyer was hired to go out and do a study of remaining stocks, and based on that study that it did, They did the Magnuson Act, which effectively pushed our economic borders out to 200 miles, which they were able to stop, you know, some of the foreign fishermen from coming in. And so that after the study, the boat, knowing where all the fish were, went out and participated in catching them again. And I talked to one of the deckhands who was on the boat back then, was in the 50s. And he said that one time they caught, 70 tons of ocean perch. And the captain radioed in to Seattle to see what the market rate was for the fish. And it was a penny a pound, and they were feeding it to minks at mink farms. And it wasn't worth him going back in. So they dumped, you know, these 70-year-old fish out on the on the water, and their swim bladders were all distended because they were brought up quickly. And so the deckhand said, as far as you could see, there was just these orange floating mass of, you know, and everybody at the time knew that this was not sustainable. So that's just sort of the life the boat had. But it would go from one fishery to another. And a guy named Kevin Bailey documented the boat's history after the Sea of Cortez. And he calculated that the fisheries would last on order of about 9 years. After all the fishermen would pounce on a certain fishery, they would deplete it in about 9 years each time. So that's what happened with it after.
Oof. Yeah, that's a depressing story. The story of one rape after another of a fishery. My gosh. Anyway, well, that's kind of ancillary to our story here, but that's part of the life and times of the Western Flyer. So, you know, you mentioned, John, that it's going to go back to sea at some point. So, just quickly, was it? I guess you're trying to refurbish it as much as possible in a realistic way. Is it hard to find the correct antique fittings and parts, and how much of it are they making from scratch without going into too much detail? Is there, you know, regular modern technology on it? I assume there must be.
Yeah, in fact, we're going to make the boat. You know, it's going to be kind of a wolf in sheep's clothing. It'll look from a distance like the old fish seiner, but inside it's going to be pretty modern. We're putting a hybrid propulsion in it, so it'll be basically electric-powered. And we're going to have a full ocean depth ROV in it, so we can go down basically 4,000 meters with an inspection class ROV to do certain things. So one of the things we're going to do is derelict fishing gear collection. You know, there's a lot of ghost fishing traps and, mm-hmm. and nets and stuff, so we'll collect those. We're also setting out data loggers, which we're developing, which will monitor, you know, the normal stuff, the temperature and salinity and that sort of thing, dissolved oxygen. But the holy grail for measurements now is pH. It's actually, you know, it's easy to measure pH in a high school lab, but it's really hard to do it at the bottom of the ocean where you can't calibrate your instruments very well and you have to leave them for long periods of time. We're going to have data loggers down for a couple of years and they'll be collecting pH data. There's not a good regional study of pH right now along the coast. And so we'll have 60 of these data loggers in, and the flyer will go out and place them and collect them for dumping their data. And it's important because if you're a little foraminifera or diatom or something that has a calcium carbonate shell and the ocean's getting slightly more acidic because it's absorbing more CO2, then, you know, a slight change in acidity will prevent you from, you know, precipitating your shell out. So, you know, it's the base of the food chain, and it's not well understood. There's pockets where they're monitoring it very closely, but we'll be monitoring it from Mexico to Alaska. So it'll be an important long-term sort of study.
Well, that's great that it'll be used for scientific monitoring of the ocean environment. Are you going to be also taking charters at all, or?
No, I'm going to try to keep the mission pretty purely scientific and educational. We'll be taking out teachers and trying to train the trainers, basically. You know, I have a 16-year-old daughter. She came home from school one day when she was a couple years ago, and she had been learning the parts of a cell and memorizing it. And she goes, like, I can't believe you like science. It's so boring. And it just crushed me, you know, because I saw it from her point of view. Like, you learn science that way. It's just awful. But, you know, to me, you look at the relationships between different things that live in the ocean, it's amazing. And it's just not being taught that way. And I think if we can teach teachers to look at it a little differently and look at it like Ricketts did, where things aren't just a taxonomic, you know, a isolated creature. They live in communities and they interact, and the way they interact is super interesting. And I you know, I've never taken anybody in a tide pool that, you know, wasn't instantly childlike and gleeful when you start seeing how things, you know, interact with each other. And that was what I think the genius of Ricketts was. And I'm trying to recreate that a little bit.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with John Gregg in California. He's a geologist, and he's bought and is renovating, at considerable expense, a boat, a former fishing boat called the Western Flyer, that was used by John Steinbeck and his friend Ed Ricketts back in 1940 to do a biological collecting expedition in the Gulf of California off of the mainland Mexico coast. So John is renovating this boat. But let's turn, John, to Steinbeck, and particularly Ed Ricketts. I had never heard of him, but apparently it was such an unusual, charismatic, and memorable character that even today, nearly 70 years after his death, he's famous among marine biologists. And you were just describing a little bit of why. And there are people in Northern California, I understand, who are almost a cult and call themselves Edheads, kind of like parrotheads or something. So tell us a little bit about Ed Ricketts, just as a person.
Yeah, he was a really interesting guy. I think everybody that ever came in contact to him was sort of changed by him. He was an unassuming guy, But he studied marine biology in Chicago and didn't finish his degree. He had a habit of, you know, not being very discreet with his romantic adventures, and he started a relationship with one of his professor's wives and was asked to leave the university. So he went down to South Carolina, actually walked to South Carolina.
Oh, good.
And while he was walking, people would ask him, what are you doing? Why are you walking from Chicago to South Carolina? And when he told them, oh, he was just trying to clear his head, they'd get a little nervous of that answer.
Yeah.
And, you know, their purses a little closer. But
keep moving.
He finally started telling people he lost a bet, and they were fine with that then. Then they understood it. But he made his way out to California and started this Pacific Biologic Lab, which would collect sea specimens for high schools for dissection and study. And it was a nice little business, and he ran it there on Cannery Row, as you said. And around 1938, he met John Steinbeck, and I think became a giant influence on Steinbeck from there on, as he was to a lot of other people too. Henry Miller and Joseph Campbell would hang out at the lab and sort of learn from Ricketts. And, you know, in fact, Campbell spent a lot of time with Ricketts, and they discussed a lot of things. Ricketts had taken this butcher paper and covered the walls of his lab with it, and without Wikipedia or Google or anything, wrote basically every big event in human history that he could find, you know, all the wars and the famines and everything. And he noticed patterns would emerge where after a big famine or a war or something tragic, there would be this renaissance where there would be a burst of art and music and science. And he traced those patterns, and it was what Stephen Jay Gould, who was a sort of Darwin scientist, later called punctuated equilibrium. And that was Ricketts' genius. He could see patterns, larger patterns, and, you know, by looking at things. And Steinbeck basically paraphrased it by saying, you know, you look from the tide pool to the stars and back again, and that's how you could make these connections. But Joseph Campbell, from these talks, went on to write Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is about how every culture has the story of Homer and his Odyssey. And I guess that was basically, George Lucas used that as the basis for his Star Wars series. So you could say that, you know, if you squint a little bit, you can say that the whole Star Wars trilogy had its, or whatever it is up to now, had its basis in that little dusty lab in Cannery Row. And that's how Ricketts was. He affected everybody like that. I guess he was totally without judgment, is what people said about him. He would talk to everyone the same, whether it was a kid coming down to talk to him about, you know, a tide pool thing, or one of the working girls from Cannery Row with romantic problems, or the mayor. You know, he talked to everybody the same and without judgment, and that's what people loved about him.
Well, I've read about him, you know, and if you read the log from the Sea of Cortez, again, the book of their expedition, which I think is kind of a follow-on to a more scientific book, but this particular book, the log from the Sea of Cortez, was largely written by Steinbeck. But at the end of it, after Ed Ricketts was killed, basically his car was hit by a train, and so he died fairly young, but Steinbeck wrote a really lengthy kind of memoir, almost like a eulogy in a way, but a description of Ed Ricketts. And he's just, you know, as we've been describing, is a very unusual scientist. They're usually pretty conservative, but this is like a guy who continued the womanizing that you mentioned way on, you know, and he loved women and always had a number of them around, and he wasn't a one-woman man by any means. And he also liked beer, and he would start, you know, he drank quite a bit, and he partied. I mean, they would kind of, his lab was alternatingly a research lab and party headquarters for kind of the eclectic, artsy, and intellectual set around Monterey, which was already, you know, by the late 30s, collecting to be a pretty interesting group of people. But he was a Renaissance man who could talk art and literature and philosophy as well as anybody alive. I mean, you talked about his influence on the great mythologist Joseph Campbell. I mean, you know, so, and Steinbeck himself drew a lot of his kind of holistic worldview, as you said, from knowing Ricketts. And it ties into kind of the thing we've been talking around a little bit, but up until that time, I think biologists had looked they'd specialize, each biologist would specialize in a species, right? So they would look in a kind of a silo effect vertically at that species and see its characteristics and, you know, how the, what the range of characteristics and features and behavior within a given species was, but without considering all the other species around it that it lived with. And so Rickett's kind of genius was to look at what I think today is called ecological biology, to look at the whole, as you use the word, community, to look at the whole ecology of the general area that a species was living in, and then maybe to look at individual species. So that he kind of started that whole, what is today's modern day way of approaching biology, and a pretty interesting guy, to put it mildly. I mean, we're kind of getting to the end of the story, but let me just ask you this kind of odd question. Has this whole journey, which has gone on for at least 15 years, John, and, you know, even longer than that, if you take your fascination with it back to when you were a kid, has it been worth it all? I haven't asked you how much it costs, this renovation, but I'm assuming it's probably over the $1 million you spent for this wreck to start with, right? So has the whole thing really been a big part of your life and become really worth it to you?
It really has. Like, it's probably, you know, it's going to be $3 or $4 million by the time it's all done. And it's going to cost a couple $1 million to run as an, you know, an ongoing thing. But I feel like I'm so lucky that I got involved with this because I've met so many really interesting people. And like you said, there's not a marine biologist anywhere, I think, that doesn't know about Ed Ricketts and this little six-week voyage. And it really was the start of people being cognizant of the limits of the ocean and resources. Up until, you know, the 40s, people really did think the ocean was limitless and you could fish it or mine it or do whatever you want without any recourse. It was just, it was bottomless basically. And he started, you know, with the sardine catches. He chronicled their decrease and really was the first voice of, you know, you should watch out. And I'm still learning that lesson. They built that boat in a few months in the Pacific Northwest from wood harvested within 30 miles of it. It was Douglas fir and, you know, there was an unlimited supply of that in the 30s. I made this silly rule that all this wood had to be sustainably harvested that we're rebuilding the flyer with. And so there's a organization that will stamp it, you know, sustainably sourced. And the organization is based actually in Germany. And so the wood that we're planking it with is a sapile, which is an African teak wood, which was apparently sustainably harvested in the Congo, then went to Germany to get stamped, and then went from Germany to France to get milled, and from France to the Pacific Northwest. So the carbon footprint of my sustainably harvested wood is just egregious. And so, you know, you learn these things, and it's sobering because it really is difficult to source some of the materials that were readily abundant just, you know, a generation ago.
Well, John, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I honestly feel like I should thank you for being a guy who's not, you know, in this sort of business at all. You're not an historian, you're not a government employee, you're not a novelist, but you're just somebody who developed a passion to find this boat and bring it back to life, and you're doing that, and it's a really, really great thing. But I want to encourage our listeners also to read The Log from the Sea of Cortez, which is the story of that trip and also the back 50 pages or so, the story of Ed Ricketts. Well, I want to thank you again, John, for being on with us and telling the story.
I appreciate the interest. Thanks, Gord.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.